Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across time and space, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording at just about the midnight hour, June 1st, 2013. This would be nav briefing number 68, and the title is Human Nobility. Well, I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm still reeling from the two recent briefings. Number 66, Truth on the Planetary Scale, and number 67, Lydia's Vow. You know, I seem to have arrived at the place with these briefings where I speak in such a manner that I can shift my own assemblage point. I came out of those two briefings literally spinning like a top and wondering what direction I would be facing when the spin stopped. There is now something happening to me and to the GNE, something happening to all of you who follow it intimately and passionately. Something that I cannot exactly define, although you may recall a few briefings back, I said that the GNE was shifting. And at that time, I used the analogy of ballast, and I said the mothership is shifting, and the ballast has been shifted toward the foredeck, toward the bow of the ship. Curiously, the last time that Kundry and I happened to look up at the sky from my terrace here and observe the Big Dipper, we saw once again that the alignment of the two pointer stars to the North Star was way, way, way off. And when this happens, this anomaly appears in the sky. Some of you also have observed it over the last 2 years. When this happens, it always coincides with a moment of particular intensity in the GNE. Now, I want to reiterate what I said about the coming 2 years between now and the completion of the 3 years of initialization of correction. Rather than look for and expect that PT and Sophia's correction would break through in the world at large, although not precluding that, let's concentrate on the intramural aspects of this experiment. Let's concentrate on what those of us in GNE and Planetary Tantra are doing with our lives and doing with this Gnostic intel and the power-sharing arrangement of the Shakti cluster. Let's concentrate on all that and sort things out among ourselves, and let's make that the priority for the next year. I'd like to address a couple of comments, questions, or reservations, whatever you want to call them, that have come in since those two recent talks, just to make sure that my delivery is as clear as it can be. In the first place, one loyal crew member, the Honorable Dame Miriam, expressed some dismay or disappointment at the thought that we might not be seeing effects or evidence or proof of Sophia's correction in the world at large. I did not mean to say that we would not see any. I merely said that the anticipation aspect of this experiment, which is so powerful, needs to be focused on what we do among ourselves. It needs to be focused on our mastery of the experiment and our involvement in Planetary Tantra. So I'm not precluding that something could happen in the world at large. In fact, I'm quite certain that it will. But I would advise you to make that a secondary concern and to gear your anticipation more toward the experiment itself, toward myself, the navigator, and to those of you on the crew who are manning and womaning the vital tasks and the delights and joys that come along with being on the mother ship. Secondly, I got a polite query raising the question, well, John, are you saying yet that you're the only person in the world who can see the organic light or who has encountered the organic light? Certainly, I am not saying that. I myself have encountered the organic light and witnessed it in the presence of several other people. And I've had that experience confirmed objectively, if you will, by a second witness. Moreover, I think I made it clear that I invite any accounts and testimonials that people send in regarding what may or may not have been an encounter with the organic light. And so obviously, if that's my attitude, I don't assume that I'm the only person who can access it. My claim is, A, that I am the first person to disclose its nature, its role in the ancient mysteries, and the specifics of its manifestation and its activity to the human witness. And B, that I can, yes, in my process, in my practice as a telestic shaman, I can, yes, deliberately and repeatedly access the organic light. And I can command the light using the sound of the fishes. Those are my claims. And the time has come for me to demonstrate those claims and to show to people who come here how it is done and how they themselves can do what I do. And that is the great portal which has now opened as of the weekend of the full moon of May 2013, the portal into the new epoptia, as I explained in NB 67, Lydia's Vow. So I hope all that is crystal clear. And I would like to add, again, another point regarding the organic light, since I'm going to be talking about it continuously from this point onward. The experience of light, of illumination or enlightenment, is obviously pervasive in the mystical and supernatural record of our species, isn't it? There is probably no other metaphor more common than the metaphor of seeing the light in mystical experiences. So if you read the first-hand account of Jacob Burmese's mystical experience that he had, this would be in Cosmic Consciousness by Maurice Buck. If you read the first-hand account of Jacob Burmese's revelation as he gazed upon a pewter dish that was struck by a ray of sunlight coming through the window of his humble shoemaker's hut, you have an experience of illumination, enlightenment, a description of light. The Renaissance alchemist Paracelsus wrote extensively about the nature of light, and he distinguished in the Dog Latin of alchemical writings two kinds of light, the lux naturae and the lumen naturae. By the lux naturae, Paracelsus meant the light of nature, that is to say, the light that flows through the atmosphere of the earth, which is itself invisible but renders objects visible. By lumen naturae, he referred to the organic light. Again, all through the alchemical literature, the Sophic hydrolith, the philosopher's stone, the white stone, are references to the organic light, but not all references to light and illumination and enlightenment in mystical literature refer to the encounter with the organic light. So what I want to emphasize at this moment and again as required is that the experience of the organic light, which is an encounter, in the physical world with your eyes open is absolutely the same for everyone. That is why the Gnostics equated the light with aletheia, which is the Greek word for truth. They said that this light is truth. It is truth. And what is the truth of the organic light? It is the one single, inviolable, and indisputable truth that proves the presence of the Aeon Sophia in the material world. It is the proof and evidence of her material immanence. That's what they meant when they called it aletheia, truth. And I have considered all through the past years, before Not in His Image was published, and even more seriously and deeply since it has been published, I have considered carefully the handicap that I face when I present the reality of the organic light as if it were a single and exclusive event. Therefore, I appear to be taking some form of presumptive or totalitarian stance against other experiences, other mystical experiences of light. This is not the case, my friends. You can have as many experiences of light and illumination as you wish. Eyes closed, eyes open, whatever you like. But the experience of the organic light is absolutely the same for everyone who has it. And I ask you to consider that that criterion, that is the criterion that you have seen it. Every human animal sees it in the same way. It is not a light that dazzles you. It is not a light that overcomes you inwardly by a rush. It is not a light that is bright and crashes upon you like lightning. It is a soft marshmallow textured light that emerges from the material substance of the planet. It shines out of matter. And this is a unique property of the organic light, as I have explained in detail. When you see that, you know what you are seeing. When you see the organic light, you know that you have a direct physical encounter with an indisputable truth of this world. And the beauty of that light is the greatest beauty in this world and in the source of all other beauty. And the beauty and power of that light is your birthright as a human animal. So I will leave it there at this moment, but obviously I have a lot more to say. You know, I started talking about myself in, what, NB66. I have to be careful when I start talking about myself because I never know where I'm going to end up. And when I spoke of truth on the planetary scale, I brought out the obvious fact that whether or not you agree with the Sophianic vision story, whether or not you find truth in it in its complete form, you want to take part of it, make up your own truth and add it to it. I can't do anything about what people do with the Sophianic vision story, but there is one irrefutable truth about that story, and that is that I am the single person on the planet who restored it, and simultaneously the person who broke the vow of silence regarding the nature and operation of the organic light. And why am I saying that? I'm saying it to come to terms with it. And I rely on you to come to terms with it with me. I have never relied more on your sobriety as crew members. And I mean, you got to be sober. And you've got to be steady to stand in this situation with me and make a reckoning of what this means. and how we who practice planetary tantra are going to handle it, no matter what happens in the world at large, no matter if, when, and how Sophia's correction breaks through. She shatters and brings down the work of the Archons. She dispels the Zadokite lie of history, the lie of the psychopathic predators who use the victim game to deceive and dominate others. No matter what happens out there, in that theater of insanity we call the collective social world, we must reckon on how we handle what we know. And I know that you send me love and support, and I can feel it. And I rely on that more now than ever, as I come to terms with the bare facts of what I have done. I have to tell you, I haven't really thought about it until now, not in the way that I am thinking about it now. What kind of a chance did I take? What kind of a challenge did I put before the human race by doing what I did? You know, these are questions that I live with, and I ask you and invite you to live them with me, because I simply can't get through this alone. One more thing I would say before going directly to the specific topic of this briefing is that the GNE is on a course of dead reckoning right now. Dead reckoning is a nautical term. Go look it up. We entered a course of dead reckoning some time ago. Dead reckoning means when a moving craft, like a boat, is on a course that will take it to a particular destination, and it is at that point on the course where there will be no variation that can prevent it from reaching that destination. It's in dead reckoning. And there are certain factors you can use in your imagination and self-observation to remind yourself that we are in dead reckoning. And one of these factors is the issue of entheogenic plants, the issue of the sacred plant medicines and their role in the fate of the human race, their role in the great battle that is taking place and culminating now on this planet, the battle at the end of this kalpa, the battle for human sanity and for decency and for kindness, the battle for freedom, including cognitive liberty, that is to say, the freedom to explore one's own consciousness. If you go to the psychonautics section of metahistory.org, which you get to from a button on the home page, you'll find the one entry there, Three Generations of Psychonauts. This is an incomplete section of the site, but if you scroll down, you'll see that in February of 2008, under a Jupiter-Venus conjunction in the Archer with the balsamic moon in the Scorpion beneath Antares, I posted this first material, and I stated, quote, "Where an individual stands on the issue of access to psychoactive plants will determine more than any other issue how that individual engages in the coming planetary shift," end quote. Well, I would repeat verbatim that quotation today, except I would change the word from coming to current. What gauges for the human animal his or her position in the current planetary shift, and what gauges your stance in the events to transpire due to Sophia's correction is the matter of where you stand on this issue. It is one of the key factors, perhaps the key factor, in the dead reckoning of the Gaian navigation experiment, which is to say, our participation in Sophia's correction. You know, as soon as I finished Not in His Image, And the book came out, I stood there facing the question, well, what the fuck am I going to do now? When people ask me about encountering the organic light, am I going to say everyone has to take some sacred medicine plant in order to reach the heightened state of consciousness, ego death, and immersion, where you can encounter the organic light? No, I'm not going to say that, and I never did. And I couldn't say that then, and I won't say it now. But I'm in the process of saying something else. And so bear with me as I find the words to say this. Lydia's vow, the last briefing, was a huge step in that direction. For me, personally, it was a huge step in how to say correctly and ethically, in the ethically and psychologically correct manner, how to say what can be done for human animals to come into the presence of the organic light. Good, good. So here we are at the 20-minute mark. And to go directly into the material of this briefing, I want to give you an update on our navigation parameters. That, after all, is my role as a nav, even though in the last couple of lectures I've spoken of my experience as a Nahual or telestic shaman, I really need to concentrate in these briefings on the navigation process according to the initial agreement of those who joined the experiment, right? So I'd like to say that this evening, which is June 1st, is the 23rd day of the shift of Kematsu. I'm calling it Kematsu now. It's a name that combines the dual overseeing of this period by Bhudevi or Bhuvaneshwari, who is the goddess of earthly richness, abundance, and good fortune, and the wrathful green Tara, who is known as the Selector. I find that it's genial, after all. The Kematsu name is proving, in my experience, to be genial. For one thing, it allows me to take in the frequencies of the two overseeing Dakinis as a unity. I'm beginning to see that they work as a unity. Let me tell you a little bit about what my experience of this shift has been since it opened up, which would have been on the 11th of May. Well, first of all, I got a little saying. I wouldn't call it Dakini instruction, but you might call it one of those little advisory sayings that comes to mind sometimes in the course of a shift. And there's something about it that sounds lovely and is easy and is attractive. And that in itself hints to me that it may be associated with the Dakini instruction. Fate and fortune lead the dance. This is the phrase I got. Fate and fortune lead the dance. And as I have been experiencing the DI, Dakini instruction, for this shift, I find that the spontaneous process in my own mind that comes to the forefront is a new way of thinking, a new way of perceiving the issue of fortune. Fortune is a word of the Kamatsu shift. Fortune. What is fortune and what is your fortune? Well, one thing, a terma is a fortune. The terma of Gaia Awakening is your fortune. It most certainly is. It's not my fortune. It's yours. And the terma of Gaia Awakening is part of the fortunate moment that you are living in. You are a human animal living in the fortunate moment on this planet when the Aeons of Fire has released to humanity the instructions for interactivity with her in her correction. Now, is that a fortunate moment or not? This concept of fortune that comes in the mood and ambience of the Kamatsu instruction is beautifully attractive. It's beautifully malleable. I find myself thinking about and experiencing in circumstantial and existential situations a different response to opportunity, opportunity being another word of Kamatsu. And I find a kind of understanding of a cosmic law of opportunity, including fate and fortune in that law. So make it a trinity. You put the word opportunity right in front of your eyes, right at eye level. The word opportunity. You know what opportunity means, huh? You want opportunity, don't you? We need opportunity in order to live. And life thrives from growing, increasing, and diverse opportunities. So put the concept of opportunity right in focus between your two eyes at eye level. And then on the left of it, situate fate. And on the right, situate fortune. And you have this triangle. See, opportunity depends on fate and fortune. Fate and fortune lead the dance. What dance is that? It's the dance of life. Your life is your first fortune. Your health is your fortune, and you better believe that. Health is a fortune. The lack of health is fate. See? What Kimatsu brings to mind in her instruction is not like the Dakini instruction that I've had before. Her instruction is not a hard-edged, cogent, and brutally rapid syntax, as is the case with some of these Dakini instructions. Her instruction actually is in a cadence that accords very, very closely with the normal frequency of your thinking. And her instruction is an entrainment toward an improved, enhanced understanding of the conditions of opportunity in your life and the conditions of the lack of opportunity. Kamatsu brings a dispassion toward your own situation, but it's an empowering dispassion. And it also with it comes, with the wrathful green Tara, with her input into the instruction, comes the warrior's courage to stand fast in fate and fortune both. And this comes in this instruction comes not, as I said, in that lightning crystal elixir Dakini syntax, which has an escape velocity that eludes many of you, I know. It comes in a very accessible frequency. And I wonder if you, in your dreaming and thinking and conversing and pondering over these last 3 weeks since the 11th of May, have been picking up on some of what I'm saying. There's an opportunity with Kamatsu and under her instruction to see your fate and your fortune differently, to understand that in your life which cannot be changed and contrast it to that which can be changed. You know, in a way you could say that that old cliche of a prayer, the serenity prayer that they used in the recovery movements, although it comes from a corrupted Christian source, which would be Reinhold Niebuhr, a Christian theologian, that the syntax of that serenity prayer has a feel and an element of the Kimatsu instruction in it. I won't say God, I'll say goddess, okay? Goddess, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That's the serenity prayer used to close every AA meeting, every 12-step meeting. There's something of the syntax of Kamatsu in that. Your fate is what you cannot change. You embrace and you love what you cannot change. Your fortune is what you can change. And fate and fortune are toggled together on a switch. And there is actually a switch the fate fortune switch. It's like a wall switch of a light. Now, the second thing I would note, another thing I would note about the Kematsu instruction is that she is, if anything, I'm reticent to use this term, but she is, if anything, something like a life coach. I mean, get that. This is funny. She's like a life coach, folks. The instruction that she gives is gently but lucidly insinuated into the cadence of your day-to-day circumstances. The people that you meet, the opportunities that come up by a contact through email, an appointment that you have, a business arrangement, a professional connection, material and spiritual, I'm beginning to hate this word, spiritual, material and spiritual affairs are mingled. And it's all the same to her. She handles it all the same. The life coach will show you how to make the best of these circumstances. And the key to receiving Kematsu instruction, I find, is to act on it as it's actually happening. So, for instance, I had the occasion of two extraordinary meetings under her shift. Two extraordinary meetings, and one of them was from a visitor who was unannounced, and another one was the visit of the Pachamama medicine woman and her apprentice. And so I had the opportunity, which doesn't come often to me, I'll tell you, to receive here in Under the Sea while I'm here and not traveling elsewhere in Europe, such as up north, to receive here people who bring resources and opportunities and contact and communication and questions and answers and so forth. And I found that I found myself in a dance led by fortune and fate. Fortune and fate lead the dance. What does this mean? If you lead the dance, if you have a partner in your arms and you lead the dance, it means that your steps of your two feet lead the dance. The two steps are fortune and fate. They lead the dance of life. And so I found that by responding immediately to these encounters, I moved through them in a new way. I moved through them with ease. I moved through them with confidence and with a great sense of direction. Because I did not in any way postpone or retard the fortunate moment. So one of the lessons of Kematsu is do not delay the fortunate moment. The fortunate moment that comes to you, any time that something comes to you as an opportunity in life to change your fortune, that is to give you a more, to increase your range of self-expression and increase the range of your love and your power, you move into that opportunity and that situation with a certain cadence, with a certain bounce, a certain lilt in your step. And that is an indication that you are actually incorporating the frequency of Kematsu instruction. Also, there's a great deal more that has come up out of this instruction. And I must say, again, I can characterize the DI, the intel, the subliminal intel of this Dakini is quite distinct. I think it's distinct now because I'm receiving the two frequencies concordantly. Did you get that? I'm receiving the Tara Selector frequency and the Budevi Abundance frequency simultaneously. You have to think always of abundance and selection together, because when you have abundance, you face the question of selecting whom to share it with. And when you're in the process of selecting people, you face the question of retaining in your life those people who bring abundance. So you see, selection and abundance are synergetic principles. And I think for the first time in going through this shift now since 2008, I'm getting the two frequencies in a simultaneous merge. And that merge has a particularly sweet cadence to it. And it doesn't impose. It just sort of rolls into your feelings and rolls into your mind and gives a boost. It adds a boost, synergetic boost. And I've been getting, therefore, thoughts and concepts, and I would call them more, I would say, initiatives. I find that I'm getting very powerful initiatives, and they are formulating themselves extremely clearly. To put it in plain English, projects. You know, have you been thinking in the last 3 weeks of any particular projects? Have you had some project you would like to do in your life come into definition? Or is there some tangential or circumstantial event that has triggered your desire to engage in a project? You see, it's about projects and initiatives. And I find that I have been feeling an augmented sense of projects that I wish to undertake, projects that have existed in the past, which for one reason or another have not panned out, are coming back in a new light, and new projects on the horizon are defining themselves. And I find that in the definition of these new projects, these new initiatives of my creative and imaginative life, that the definition, the initial definition, and the initial conditions are perfect. That is an assurance of the success of the project, as much as an assurance as you can have in a world where nothing is certain and nothing is absolutely predetermined. And so there's a growing sense of confidence. Also, let's remember that Jupiter moved during this shift out of the bull. It leaped through the horns of the bull and moved into the twins. And this, too, represents metaphorically, or in the cosmic representation of our human reality, it represents a leap forward in confidence. Now, I have a lot to say about the fate fortune switch, as I'm calling it. And as I say that, I want you to visualize a light switch on a wall, okay? And I actually thought of dedicating this briefing, number 68, entirely to that subject. I changed my mind on that, and I might do a second briefing, a second part to NB68, in order to talk about that wonderful subject and to go into the dynamics of the complementarity of fate, that which you cannot change, and fortune, that which you can change, that which can be changed for you. And so that's coming up, that's brewing. That's imminent. But for right now, to return to the parameters of navigation, we're on the hinge of the Kamatsu shift, and there are many, many solutions in the air. I could not even begin to tell you the solutions that I'm seeing. For instance, I see a solution to the problem of the master race disease. Yeah, I do. I see a solution to it. I also see a solution to the problem of Christianity versus Zionism. And that's a very big issue. I have, by the way, some YouTube research to recommend to you. And that topic of Christianity versus Zionism, which may sound a little obscure right at the first introduction, ties in very closely with a particular element in our navigational parameters, of which I don't speak very often. That is Saturn. Now let me update you on what's happening with the planet Saturn. You recall that at the beginning of the 3 years of initialization of correction, Saturn stood around 16 degrees of the sign Libra. Okay? March 2011, Saturn stood around 16 degrees of the sign Libra. That is in the apsides of Jupiter. Now remember the saying, the correction of the Aeon Sophia takes place in the apsides of Jupiter. So it's no accident that the planet Saturn was there at the very beginning of the initialization of her correction. Now, what I've noted more recently, I don't talk about Saturn that often. What I have noted more recently, however, is that Saturn is going to repeat the positions that occurred with the complex series of hits of the lunar perigee in the scales. Remember that? We followed the hits of the lunar perigee through the scales. In the right pan, the left pan, back to the right pan, then 20th of August, or rather 23rd of August, 2012, the one single hit at the fulcrum of the scales. Remember that? Okay. Where is Saturn now, and what can I give you for intel that would be helpful? Well, the remarkable thing about Saturn right now is that you can see it in the night sky, and it has been in a retrograde loop ever since the 20th of February this year. On the 20th of February, Saturn had advanced from the Virgin into the scales, and it was actually in the right pan. That would be in 12 degrees of Scorpio on the ecliptic scale. Then it moved backwards and edged back into the Virgin again. So it is currently in the Virgin. And its retrograde cycle takes, as you know, 5 months. During that 5 months, Saturn moves back about 7 degrees, which is 14 times the diameter of the full moon. And you can actually watch it moving back, and you can watch it then when it turns direct and moving forward again. Saturn turns direct in the month of July, about 40 days from now, on the 8th of July, in 5 degrees of Scorpio, which is in the hem or at the knee of the Virgin. And then it proceeds to make its final pass from the Virgin into the scales. And we anticipate Saturn to be close to the fulcrum of the scales at the completion of the initial conditions in May 2014. So this is the picture. This is the picture of Saturn. And what is notable about the current retrograde loop of Saturn from the 20th of February to the 8th of July is that it makes 3 passes over the star Cambalia, which is in 8 degrees of Scorpio. The star Cambalia marks the absolute limit of the composite stars of the constellation of the Virgin before the stars of the constellation of the scales can be detected. It's not only the boundary star of the constellation of the Virgin, but as you know, the star carries a unique significance. It's a very indistinct star, and yet it has been called the Alchemist Star, and it carries a unique significance in terms of the alchemy of the planetary animal mother for the transmutation of the Anthropos from 10 to 11. So the planetary animal mother from within the experiment is actually able to transmute the next version of Anthropos. And this is what we are observing to the best of our ability by the timing of the lunar perigee hits. Okay, remember all that. This is basic intel for Gaia navigation. Okay? Now here for your record are the dates of the 3 transits, it's called the triple pass, the 3 transits of Saturn over Cambalia. The first one occurred at the end of December 2012. That's right, my friends. So while the whole world was anticipating December 21st, 2012, Millions and millions of people in the world were anticipating that event. You in the GNE, by selection and by self-election, were observing the transit of Saturn to Kambalia in the context of the meaning of Kambalia. That is to say, the power of divine alchemy manifested by the Aeon Sophia within her own experiment. December 21st, 2012. The second pass occurred in May, not too long ago, at the beginning of this month, May. Tremendous moment, the beginning of this month, May. And there was, of course, that massive solar eclipse, which concluded the Merita cycle. And finally, after Saturn turns direct on July 8th, upcoming, in the first week of September 2013, it will make its third and final pass over Kambalia. Well, what do you think of when you think of the first week of September? Well, I don't know about you, Mimedes, but I go back to the first week of September 2012 when I sat on that porch right out there before dawn and saw for the first time the celestial anchor, which is the real, objective, empirical evidence of the attainment of planetary relay by the Aeon Sophia. Pleromic relay of the Aeon Sophia. That is to say, the alignment through the Pleiades of the planet Earth to the Pleroma, the galactic center. So on the first anniversary exactly of Pleromic relay is the third pass of Jupiter to Kambalia. Now, you might recall, speaking of Jupiter, that I proposed at some point along the way to call it the light ship. We're using the nautical analogy here. The nautical analogy is not just an analogy. It is actually the tool of the Gaian navigation experiment. If we call the Earth a mother ship, it's not just a metaphor, is it? It's calling it what it is. It's calling the planet what it is. And so we know that Jupiter is sort of like the tug. We understand that Jupiter was involved in pulling the mothership into position in the first 6 or 8 months after March 2011, pulling her past the satanic head of Cetus and pulling her into a position where she could begin to assume two functions, self-propulsion and self-navigation. So we'll stay, roughly speaking, with a nautical metaphor. Jupiter is the tug. We can call Mars the warship or the fire boat or whatever you want to call it. I'm not sure yet. I don't have a clear sense of nor do I have any evidence of how Mars figures in Sophia's correction, astronomically speaking. But what about the light ship? Now, think about what a light ship is. A light ship is a lighthouse on a ship. So, here is the mothership, the planet Earth, starting to assume its own navigation and its own propulsion and free itself from the capture of the archontic planetary system. This is the astronomical event of correction. And I mean that literally, folks. We are living in the 10 seconds of Sophia's time when she initially sets her engines and sets her sails to undertake this journey by her own anoia and her own pronoia linked to the pleromic eons. This is reality. This is not a story that I'm making up. This is not a myth. This is a mythopoetic way of describing an event that is underway, an event that involves the planet Earth in its cosmic journey through the galaxy. And how wonderful is it that there's a light ship out there, a light ship out there somewhere in the reaches of the galactic arm that accompanies the mother ship. So the light ship of Saturn does not represent a point of land, therefore it's not a point or destination on land from which the planetary journey is reckoned. Rather, it is a point in the sea. And the light ship does not necessarily remain in one place. As we see here, the light ship of Saturn has been moving backwards for some months now. Now let's consider the position of the Earth in relation to the visible details of the galactic arm, the local galactic arm. Today, June 1st, the Sun is in 11 degrees of the sign Gemini. That puts it very closely positioned to Aldebaran, the eye of the bull. And so on this very same day, June 1st or 2nd, the Earth is opposite. Therefore, the Earth now is coastlining. This is the term that I use. The Earth is coastlining through the constellations. The visible constellations of the zodiac, which you see at night, represent a coastline, a distant coastline. And at any particular moment, we can look from the mothership and see which part of that coastline we are closest to. We are passing in close proximity to the coastline defined by the composite stars of the Scorpion, and as a matter of fact, the mothership is passing by the star Antares in the heart of the Scorpion as I speak these words. That means that from the point of view of the mothership, the lightship of Saturn is somewhat behind it, because the lightship of Saturn is back, if you go back from left to right, that is, from east to west through the constellations. You go back from Antares in the heart of the Scorpion through the scales and back into the Virgin. And there at the knee of the Virgin is the lightship. So the Earth passed the lightship. We can know exactly what date that was. Well, April 29th, 2013. And lo and behold, and by the way, I didn't know this until I just looked it up. Lo and behold, well, the Sun on April 29th was in 8 or 9 degrees of Taurus. Now, the Earth is always exactly opposite. And so the Earth, when it passed Saturn, was in 8 or 9 degrees of Taurus, which happened to be at the moment that Saturn was conjunct Cambalia. Well, how wonderful is that? That means that on April 29th, a little over a month ago, the mothership actually passed in close proximity to the lightship. The orbit of the Earth is within the orbit of Saturn, and the Earth moves more rapidly. Therefore, the Earth passes Saturn, which stands further out toward the coastline of the visible constellations. And the Earth passed Saturn at the moment that Saturn, in its retrograde cycle, was conjunct Cambalia. Now the Earth has advanced to the Scorpion and stands aligned to Antares in the heart of the Scorpion. So the relation between the mothership and the lightship begins to be interesting here, doesn't it? Let's look at the actual parameters, folks. You know, this experiment is the most incredible type of adventure of the mind, if you want to call it that, because staying within her story, you investigate and invent new details of her story. You elaborate her story from within it, and then you go and you actually look at the astronomy to confirm the details of the story that you are elaborating. As an astronomical practice, the Gaia navigation experiment is totally verifiable against astronomical events. I've proven that time and time again. And here goes another one. I would like you to go to YouTube and type in the YouTube search bar, Peace for Germany. A number of clips will come up. You want to look at the one that is on the site of James Bacque, B-A-C-Q-U-E. There are only three videos on his channel. And he, in fact, is the principal figure in this clip, Peace for Germany, because he is the author of a book, as explained when you listen to the six-minute video clip. Now, I just listened to this for the first time today, thanks to a crew member in Germany who sent me the link. And as I listened to this clip, I learned that there was an historic meeting that took place in late October 2011 in Washington, D.C. And as it says here, the participants of that meeting were Colonel Max Klar, Bundeswehr, that's to say he's a veteran of the German Army, retired, Major Merritt P. Drucker, United States Army, retired, and James Bacque, the author of the book, Other Losses. Quote, and I am so happy and proud to read you these words. Quote, their sole interest is to publish the truth about the fate of Germans and Germany under Allied rule after World War II. End quote. Now, I was deeply moved by this clip coming up. And I would say that for me, that email from a crew member represented a fortunate moment. Now recall the instruction of Kematsu. Do not let pass the fortunate moment. If you seize the fortunate moment when it arises and move into the cadence or dance of that moment, then you may find that other opportunities configure themselves into the fortunate moment. As a matter of fact, the night before, about 12 hours before I received this link to the Peace for Germany clip, I watched a film that I rented on iTunes. I recommend that you all watch this film. It's a German film, German language with subtitles, and it's called Lore, L-O-R. So, I won't say anything about that film, except to say that my mind and imagination and emotions were deeply permeated by that film. And coming across that film last night was a fortunate moment that rolled into another fortunate moment with the arrival of this clip. And so, when I saw this clip, I was struck by the fact that they mentioned a date. That is to say, the date of the meeting of this author and these two individuals, a German Army colonel and an American Army major. And that meeting took place late in October 2011. So, I picked up this little paper right here, has a list of apogee and perigee surges on it. And I went and looked for late October 2011. And what did I find? I found that there was a perigee surge, the operation of divine alchemy, the first attention of the Aeon Sophia. There was a perigee surge in 28 degrees of Libra. Concurrent with that perigee surge, the position of Saturn was just 4 degrees off the point of the surge and 2 degrees from the star Spica. Well, this is like one of those one-armed bandits in the Las Vegas gambling casinos, okay? When the three cherries come up, This is a three-cherry moment. Perigee surge in the Virgin, one cherry. Saturn at the perigee surge, second cherry. The star Spica at the perigee surge, third cherry. Now, I have to point out that at the moment that this occurred, I didn't know this meeting was taking place, did I? And one thing that may come to pass in the annals of the GNE, my friends, is that it may come to pass that once we have made our chronicle and once we have established our own observations and reflections, insights and discoveries of the 3 years, it may come to pass that people investigating our record will go back and look at events that happened simultaneously with the apogee and perigee moments that we didn't even know were happening when we were living through them. And I don't think this instance of the perigee surge of October 26, 2011 is a rare or singular event. It's difficult to see what exactly is happening in real time in the world at large, timed to the key moments of the navigation experiment, isn't it? Because we don't have any way of knowing what's really happening out there that really matters. So we could have been looking at the news, we could have been looking at current events in October of 2011, looking for some reflection of the three-cherry event, okay? But you wouldn't have seen that because the media, the collective media, follows the agenda of the Zadokite predators who are promoting the great lie about their own racial supremacy as well as the historical lies, among which the lie about Germany and the German people stands central. You know, I've said that if the narrative of the predators and psychopaths breaks on this planet, it must break along the main seam, like a dam that breaks along the central part of the dam. And the main seam is, of course, the official version of the persecution of Jews in the 20th century. Not the persecution by Jews. Oh, no, don't hear much about that. And even if we do, well, it's entirely justified, isn't it? Of course it is, because look at the singular and paramount evil that was committed upon them. Well, that certainly gives them the right to commit any kind of evil they want with no impunity whatsoever. Well, anyway, with those Zadokite, Zionist, Bolshevik powers running the media, owning and running the media, is not going to get very good news coverage of events that might reflect Sophia's correction. But here you go. And isn't it fantastic? And what it does for me is it gives me a sense of how to define the significance of the light ship, Saturn. What is the light ship? What is the light shining in the misty sea of the galactic arms that guides the mothership in her correction? What is that light? You want me to put a name on that light for you? What is the name of the mothership? Go, we're looking at the mist. We passed by close to the mothership at the end of April 2013. And who was standing on deck and looking out, looking across the waters? And there's the lightship in the mist with the tower, with the light flashing on and off. And could you get a glimpse of the four letters on the bow of the lightship? I see now what those four letters are. A-R-Y-A. That's a Sanskrit word. You know how fond I am of Sanskrit. But you'll recognize, of course, that that Sanskrit word is the root of another word which you get if you just add the letter N. So why is that the name of the lightship? Arya. Why is that the name of the ship that carries the movable lighthouse that guides the mothership on her course in the galactic arms? Well, what does Arya mean in Sanskrit? It means noble. Noble. And you know, by the way, I should point out that the root of the word noble and the root of the word gnosis are the same. In fact, you could say gnoble, G-N-O-B-L-E. You could say gnobility, G-N-O-B-I-L-I-T-I. If you are a Gnosticoi, if you are Telestis, who has access to the ultimate source of truth on this planet, which is the organic light, then you are a member of the gnobility. You are Arya. And Arya is the shining ideal that even the Aeon Sophia herself needs to guide her. And that ideal of Arya was carried forth historically by the German and Teutonic peoples in the 20th century in a way that is absolutely incomparable. And the truth of that story can be known. The truth of that story must be known. Now, I'm not saying that Hitler was a saint, Adolf Hitler, and I'm certainly not going to idolize Hitler, because I don't. I respect Hitler a lot for what he did. And I am also confident to challenge anyone to back up with evidence the claims that are ordinarily raised to brand Hitler as a diabolical tyrant and madman who believed in Nazi eugenics of master race theory and wanted to conquer the whole world. Show me the evidence. For instance, you've probably heard the term master race. Now, have you heard the term master race in association with Jewish beliefs or a Jewish agenda? Perhaps, but more likely, you've heard master race associated with the Nazis. Hitler was following a master race ideology. Is that so? Is that really so? No, I say that Hitler was following an Aryan ideology, but not a master race ideology. So what's the difference? Well, first of all, what is the way to say master race in German? Did you ever wonder about that? I mean, he was, after all, German. He was the hero of the German-speaking peoples of Europe, of Austria, of Danzig, of other places that were not even within the territorial borders of Germany. He was the hero of all the German-speaking people, united them as the German language culture, the Teutonic culture. And if he was promoting, and he and his Nazi monster pals were promoting a master race ideology, then you go and find the term master race in Mein Kampf. You go and find the German words for master race and see if they were ever used by Adolf Hitler, ever spoken or written. And I defy you to find them, because they weren't. And so, if you want to know what Aryan means by contrast to master race, then go to the place where the master race theory is clearly defined, and that is in the Old Testament and in the Jewish Talmud and in the protocols of the Elders of Zion and in the whole Zionist Zadokite agenda. There you will find master race theory writ loud and writ large. But if you try to find master race theory in Nazi ideology by evidence, my friends, not by what's written about it, not by the volumes that claim that it is there, but the evidence that actually shows it is there. You see the difference? Sure, you can read 6 books that will tell you that the Nazis were pursuing master race ideology. But can you find any actual evidence that that is true? That is much, much harder to do. And so, leave the master race theory where it originated. Leave it with the people who invented it. Leave it with the people who proudly and flagrantly promote it to this day. And turn to the Germans and see the people of Arya, the history of what is really human nobility and human excellence. You know, one of the solutions, one of the initiatives that I have received in the Komatsu shift can be stated in the concept of aratism. And I think I'm going to put this word into the internet discourse, just like I put archon into the internet discourse. The word archon is about the problem of Sophia's correction. The word arete is about the solution. Arete is the Greek word meaning excellence. What is the solution to the problem of racial supremacy on this planet? The concept of excellence. Not supremacy, excellence. Aratism would therefore be a philosophy of ethics and a philosophy of a kind of social ideology, if you will, that recognizes excellence. And every single ethnic group on this planet, every family of the Anthropos, has its own kind of excellence. I'm standing here in my little briefing room, and behind me, hanging from a shelf where I keep the Turton's treasures, is a beautiful mobile from Egypt. It shows 8 Nubian dancers made out of straw, made out of some kind of plant. 8 Nubian dancers hung by their heads from a circle. And the beauty and elegance of these simple figures of women dancing is stunning. The beauty of the motion, the real quality that is captured, the kinetic quality of a woman's body in motion is captured in a unique way by each one of these little straw figures of a Nubian dancer hanging on a mobile. That is arete. That is excellence. You can have excellence in a simple little object like that. And you can have the excellence of a Mercedes-Benz. And you can have the excellence of a Beethoven sonata. And you can have the excellence of Parzival by Wolfram von Eschenbach. And that's German excellence. And the German people, the Teutonic people, are truly an Aryan race in that they have demonstrated their excellence. And every race that demonstrates excellence, every ethnic group, every family of the Anthropos, no matter of what color, who demonstrates excellence is Aryan. And Arya is the name of the light ship. Sophia's ideal for humanity is excellence, not supremacy. Supremacy is the perversion of the concept of excellence. Supremacy is the toxic and pathological insanity that comes from people who are incapable of achieving any excellence. And so I am deeply moved by this clip of Peace for Germany. And I have much more to say about this concept of aratism and how I plan to develop it in the future. As I said, I have now the intention to put the word arete and the new term aratism on the internet, to put it into the intellectual and social and spiritual discourse of our time. And that is a contribution to Sophia's correction. and I invite you to join me in that contribution. And in order to be involved with that contribution, I encourage you to educate yourself about the true nature of the tragedy of Germany and the German people. This is a heartbreaking story. This is a heartbreaking story of the use of the Zadokite lie to shatter all that is noble and excellent in the human animal. As my final remark, I want to add, and this again is fuel for future briefings, that I said something about the solution of Zionists versus Christians. What do I mean by that? Well, if you follow up the link on the YouTube clip, Peace for Germany, you'll find that it offers you a PDF file. And this PDF file is entitled The Zionist Attack on White Civilization. Now, I haven't looked at this file. I downloaded the PDF, and there's also a long YouTube clip where someone apparently is reading this entire document. I haven't looked at it all. I haven't read it all. But I'm sure that it contains a lot of true facts. But one thing that I would observe about the Zionist attack on white civilization is that this attack, this expose of the Zionist / Zadokite agenda, which goes back to the Zadok of which I speak and not in his image, is typical of many others on the internet. It, in its competence, in its coherence, but also typical in stating a dialectical opposition between the Zionist Zadokite agenda and white Christian civilization. So, the first message that you hear coming out of this document is that the Zionists have the aim to destroy white Christian civilization. This is not true. This is not correct. The Zionist Zadokites, have the aim to destroy humanity itself. And they don't care if you're a Christian, a Muslim, a Buddhist, a Taoist, or an American Indian. And so, unfortunately, there is a dialectical opposition that leads to the impression that in order to stand up to the Zadokite agenda of genocide on this planet, which has been acted out spectacularly through Russian Bolshevik Marxism and Chinese Marxism, in order to expose and stand up against that, you have to place yourself in the camp of white Christianity. Well, I'm here to tell you that that is a very, very big mistake. And if in the initial conditions of taking down the Zadokite agenda, people position themselves as Christians opposing that agenda, they will not succeed, because Christianity itself is another extension of that agenda. But unfortunately, like Hitler himself, who was a devout Christian, as you'll see if you read his passionate words in Mein Kampf, unfortunately, Christians are unable to see the mote in their own eye, although they can see the beam in the eye of the enemy. Or I guess it's vice versa. They can't see the beam in their own eye, but they see the mote in the eye of the Zionist enemies, to use a biblical analogy. And it's extremely unfortunate that even the most intelligent Christian doesn't know the first thing about Aryan pagan values, nor are they able to detect the mechanisms of psychological projection that operate within their own psyches. But the solution out of that trap, Christian versus Zionist, is Aryanism and the restoration of the true meaning of the Aryan ideal, which is the ideal of nobility and excellence that can be manifested in any race, in any color, and in any family, among the many families of the Anthropos on this planet.